Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to the program. This is Unbelievable, your weekly program here on Premier Christian Radio that brings Christians and non-Christians together for informative discussion and debate. And a fantastic guest we have for you on today's program, Philip Pullman. I'll introduce him in just a moment. Let me tell you, though, that other guests on the program today include Martin Saunders, who is a Christian journalist who has reviewed Philip's latest book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. And we'll also be hearing from biblical scholar Anthony McCroy. Because of the short time we had in arranging this recording, Anthony unfortunately wasn't able to read the book in advance of contributing. But as you'll hear, he has plenty to say on the issues that emerge from our discussion. So let's hear this special interview between our three guests who join me on the programme today. And if you want more debate, then do keep listening. Later on in the programme, I'll give you details how you can access another Christian debate with Philip Pullman a little later on in the programme. You're unbelievable. Well, welcome along to the programme, and a real treat for you today. I've long wanted to have the main guest we have on the show today with me. Philip Pullman joins us by phone for our discussion today, and particularly in regard to his latest book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ, available through all good stores, bookshops, and you can get it online, of course. I'll put a link up with the podcast of this program for anyone who wants to get hold of the book that way. Well, Philip Pullman has, of course, made a name for himself, not only as an author, particularly of children's literature, but also as an atheist. And this is the show that very often brings Christians and atheists together to debate different points of view. And perhaps this is in some ways one of your most, I suppose, religious books, Philip. The title, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ, gives some indication of what the subject matter is. So thank you for joining us. Could we start perhaps with a little bit about where the idea for this book came from, Philip? I understand the seed was planted when you spoke to the Archbishop of Canterbury. Is that correct?
Thank you for inviting me on the programme. Yes, the seed was planted, I suppose you could say, by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, during a conversation we had at the National Theatre when the theatre was putting on an adaptation of my trilogy, His Dark Materials. Apparently the Archbishop had come to see the play and been spotted in the audience by some schoolchildren who said, why are you here? This is a play about atheists. Surely you shouldn't come and see this. And he said, well, actually, I'm quite enjoying it. And that conversation got back to Nicholas Heitner, the director of the theatre, and he invited the two of us to come and talk on stage. So we did. And in the course of our conversation, the Archbishop pointed out that whereas I discussed organized religion and criticized organized religion, indeed, in His Dark Materials, I hadn't mentioned Jesus and what part did he play in the sort of theology of the church I describe in the book. And I said, well, you're quite right, that's true, I don't mention Jesus, and I ought to deal with him. So I put that aside and thought about that, and thinking that I would come back to Jesus. But I've been thinking about Jesus and about the Christian faith for all my conscious life, because I was brought up in a Christian family. I went to church every Sunday. My grandfather was a clergyman, and I was long familiar with the stories and the rituals and the liturgy and the language, indeed, of the Christian church, the Anglican church. So it's something that's never left me, and in a sense, I wasn't doing anything new or different or strange. I was coming home, in a way, to write about Jesus.
It's a fascinating book because essentially it's almost like a fifth gospel, and you might even, you know, draw comparisons with some of the Gnostic gospels and things that are essentially alternative retellings of Jesus's life. It's part of a series that looks at the idea of myth, and can we ascertain that essentially what you're aiming to show is that whatever the true story of Jesus was, what we have is essentially someone else's interpretation, a kind of very modified, embellished form of what Jesus was and what he claimed to be?
Yes, I think that's true, but I must firstly take issue with the gospel business. This is not like a gospel, it's not meant to be a gospel, and it isn't very like a Gnostic gospel, because I'm in no sense a Gnostic. Gnostics I take to be people who believe that this world was the creation of an evil demiurge and not of the real creator God, and that our task as knowing beings, as Gnostics, is to escape from this world and get back to our source, which is inconceivably far away. Mm. That's a very dramatic story, a very exciting story to hear if you're young and you feel alienated in the world. But it's not my position. So this isn't a gospel, and it's not an attempt to be a gospel, and it's certainly not a Gnostic gospel. However, having got that straight, your second point, which is about the telling, yes, that's true. Anybody who doesn't write his own words down, but who makes an impression on people, will find that other people will write his words down and probably get some of them wrong. Or copyists will make an error, and the error will be copied, and the error will be repeated generation after generation and get bigger and bigger, and so on. And what we have in the New Testament Gospels are four accounts, four quite different accounts, of the life of a man who died roughly 40, 50 years before the first of them was written down. So inevitably, as anyone who's been on a jury will know, we can't entirely trust the literal truth of these things, not least because they differ in parts.
We'll come to that later on in the programme, and we're going to be joined at that point by Bible scholar Anthony McRoy, who has written extensively on the reliability of the Gospels, and I think it'll be a fascinating interchange. I mean, as we start out, though, Philip, I wanted to bring in at this point Martin Saunders, who's a Christian writer and broadcaster. Martin, it's great to have you with me. You have read the book. Mm. What was your overall feeling of it, you know, in terms of the way it struck you as a Christian, and in what sense did it challenge? Were you frustrated with it in any way?
Well, I think when I picked it up, I thought I was going to be very offended and upset by it. And actually, I was pleasantly surprised. I thought it was a really well-written book, a really well-told tale, as you would expect from Philip Pullman. But also, I thought there was a lot there to encourage the thinking Christian. And really, you know, we can't put our heads in the sand. We too often, at the first sign of someone coming up at Christianity with an opposing view, Christians tend to sort of bury their heads in the sand and run in the opposite direction, which doesn't say very much for our confidence and actually our faith. So I was actually, I wanted and I was determined to engage with the book. And actually I found that Philip really seemed to like Jesus. That actually there was a character who, it would seem from his retelling, he perhaps believes historically existed. Obviously, Philip, that's for you to comment on in a moment. But there was a historical character called Jesus who he believes existed. And he had actually a very positive feeling about it. And there were many things in the book, particularly earlier on, where he's describing this Jesus teacher, rabbi, who is entirely human, is not God. When he dies, he's dead. But essentially, Philip seems to quite like him, and he speaks him very warmly. And actually, that characterization comes through on the page as this as the writer liking the character, if that makes sense.
Well, before we go into a bit of kind of understanding for those who haven't read the book of what the plot is, Philip, I'd be interested in your response. Do you like the character of Jesus? I mean, what is your view of Jesus as a historical character in history?
Yeah, well, thank you. Hello, Martin. Thank you for that. It's yes, I'm pretty sure that there was a historical character called Jesus, which was a fairly common name, after all, around the time when Jesus is supposed to have lived, and I believe that that man was executed by the Romans in about AD 30 for what were clearly political reasons. So I don't doubt that there was a historical man called Jesus, and I don't doubt that he was a great teacher and a magnificent storyteller, because one of the most striking aspects of his personality, as we come across it in the Gospels, is his command of language, his command of narrative. No one who hears the story of the Good Samaritan or the prodigal son will ever forget them. They are so clear, so cogent, so powerful, such powerful examples of storytelling that they're unforgettable. And his way with words as well, which also interests me as a writer, was quite magnificent. His comparison of, you know, the man with the beam in his own eye who tries to take the mote out of his neighbor's eye, or the plank in your own eye and the speck in your neighbor. Again, that's such a powerful image, and the thing that strikes me about it is it's founded in physical truth. Jesus had been trained, we imagine, or apprenticed, anyways, as a carpenter. His father, Joseph, was a carpenter, and he must have been familiar with what it feels like to get a speck in your eye in the workshop, you know, bits of wood flying about. So it's founded in, his comparisons are founded in a profound knowledge and an affinity with the natural world, with the physical world. And that I enjoy very much, I admire very much, I applaud very much. And I think the historical Jesus, the man Jesus, was someone whom I would have greatly admired if I'd met him, but not necessarily believed him when he talked about the coming kingdom, for example.
Now, just to give a bit of background to the story without giving it all away, the idea is that you retell the story of Jesus in the form of, there were actually two boys, twins, and one was called Jesus, one was called Christ, hence the story, the title of the book, and that effectively Jesus came into a ministry of preaching and doing signs and wonders, but it was Christ who was chronicling it, his younger brother, or, well, his twin brother.
Yeah.
And that essentially, he, schooled by this somewhat shadowy figure who we seem to understand is looking to build some kind of structure that we come to see as the church, he encourages him to adapt the things that Jesus is doing and saying to fit perhaps more with something that will be conducive to bringing about this organization. And so what you get effectively is familiar stories from the Gospels, but when Jesus originally tells them, it had a different ending perhaps, or the story of what happened between him and a person is not what we read in our Gospels. And
that's right,
what we find is that Jesus has effectively been altering the outcome. Now, it's a fascinating sort of way of looking at it. Is this meant to, in some way, represent what you feel the process has been in terms of, presumably,
yes,
authors changing
things? It's not, changing, of course,
things
literally true. And I have to stress this because it's my experience that some people who criticize me believe that the Bible is literally word for word true, and that anybody writing a story must also intend that to be literally word for word true, and they can't understand analogy, metaphor, fable, and allegory, and so on. So this is a fable. It isn't meant to be literally true. The fable is does, as you say, split the character Jesus Christ into the two component parts of that name, the name and the title. And it makes Jesus the man and Christ the one who is standing back and chronicling what he does, as you say. The Christ in my story is a pure invention, of course. The Jesus, and this is the paradox, really, Jesus is true, Christ is made up. And because that that's a way I found I could talk meaningfully to me anyway about the difference between the Jesus of history and the Christ of religious mythology.
What do you make of it, Martin? Did you feel that it was a convincing sort of account that of course it's not meant to be true, but could, is this in any sense plausible for you as a way of looking at how myths develop, how stories come about, and that sort of thing?
Yes, I did think it was a plausible idea. I, and at the risk now of critiquing Philip Pullman, I'm so aware of my own tongue at this point, but I felt that it was at its strongest and best, and of course I would say this as a Christian, when it was describing this man Jesus and early on and building that character and the world around him. And to some extent the Christ story I didn't have a problem with as well. I'm not just suggesting that I only liked the bits that were paraphrases of the real, you know, original Christian texts. Where I felt it was where it maybe fell down or was slightly weaker was when Philip was trying to make some of these miraculous things that we hear about in the Bible accounts completely normal. So taking the miraculous out of them. And there were some occasions where I felt it felt a bit crowbarred.
You give an example.
One example of that would the biggest example I can think of would be the paralyzed man who gets up and walks. And he gets up and walks in Philip's version as well, except that I think the phrase is something like the man was so strengthened and inspired by the atmosphere that he was able to move. And I felt, you know, reading that just as a person coming to a piece of literature, I felt that was a little bit implausible and a little bit of, you know, jumping the shark, as they say in Hollywood.
I mean, is the intention here, Philip, to in some way rationalise how these stories may have come into being? Obviously, as an atheist, you don't believe in supernatural healing, but the gospel is awash with stories of the miraculous. Is it your view that there was some foundation to these things, but it was simply people took what was actually a natural thing and turned it into a supernatural thing?
Yeah, that's broadly what I believe. I don't believe in miracles. I don't believe they can happen. But I'm a firm believer that strange things happen, that unusual and peculiar, that extraordinary things happen from time to time. And I believe that these things can be reported and magnified and changed in the telling. It's perfectly conceivable that somebody who was whose paralysis did not have a physical cause but was caused by some sort of neurosis or something of that kind could be so overwhelmed and overcome by the powerful personality and the reverent atmosphere and the excitement around him that his neurosis or whatever it's causing the paralysis might be overcome, and he might say, I find that perfectly plausible. No reason to believe the there's any supernatural intervention.
And you do a similar thing with the story of the feeding of the 5,000, where Jesus takes some food that is offered and shares it out, and then says to everyone there, in the same way, take your food and share it out, and everyone has plenty to eat.
That's not an original blasphemy of my own. I was taught this in my RE, I think it was called RE then, O-level class back in 1963. I remember the RE teacher telling us precisely this, and I was a bit shocked at the time, but I thought, well, better write it down. So this is a quite common rationalist interpretation of something that happened.
Yeah, I mean, none of it's blasphemy, Philip, obviously, because you don't believe in God.
Oh, well, I'm glad you said that. That believes me correctly.
but I think, you know, I'm not going to fall into the trap, as Philip said right at the start, of thinking that Philip is saying, and people must get this, Philip is not suggesting that this is how it happened. The back cover, it says in big letters, this is a story. You know, get it? You know, it's not supposed to be, it didn't happen the way you believe, it happened this way. He's simply saying that it must have happened a different way. And what I guess what I'm trying to take issue with is the fact that if Philip Pullman, who is, you know, who's been named one of the greatest living writers, one of the greatest writers of the last 100 years, can't find a way to totally successfully rationalise this, then I wonder about the argument that it must have happened a different way.
Well, it would be interesting at this point to bring in perhaps Anthony McRoy, who is a Bible teacher. And it's probably worth saying at this point as well, you may be listening and the heckles are rising. If that's so, why not pen me an email and tell me what you think about the book? Perhaps you've had a chance to read it. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let's move on, and we'll introduce now Anthony McRoy. Anthony, thank you for joining us on the programme today.
You're welcome.
Essentially, what Philip has written here is a way of telling the story that sheds light, if you like. He's not saying this is how it happened, but he's saying this is the way things happen. This is the way stories develop. And as Philip's explained, he does see that what we have in the Gospels is something which is someone's understanding, interpretation. We kind of have to get through a lot of stuff before we can get back to the man Jesus. What's your take overall before we start discussing some of the particulars of that?
All right. Well, first of all, I have to say to Mr. Pullman, I'm at an enormous disadvantage in that I haven't read his book, so my apologies for that. So first of all, one thing we need to say, when we look at this historically, is that as Professor Alan Millard of Liverpool University has pointed out in his book, Reading and Writing in the Time of Jesus, it was the practice of Jews in first century Palestine to take notes on, it was a general rabbinic practice to take notes of kind of on wax tablets and so forth. So they would have done this when Jesus was teaching. Also, I think also historically we need to look at the fact that the first text in the New Testament is 1 Thessalonians, and the oldest corpus is the Pauline corpus. And Paul makes a big emphasis about his pre-Pauline tradition, like in 1 Corinthians, when he talks about the resurrection, to what I've received, I pass on to you, which was a very common rabbinic way of speaking. And he obviously is saying that he'd received this from the very earliest Christians, and it's generally thought that he was actually converted within a year or two of the resurrection and ascension. And then finally, we need to look at the fact that when the Gospels were written, there still would have been a lot of people around who knew what Jesus had said. And so the prospect for embellishment, if you like, if you want to use that term, I think was extremely limited because people would have been able to point it out. And what we've got to remember also, there were people around who were hostile to Jesus, you know, from the priesthood, you know, even maybe from some of the Romans and so forth. And if they'd said anything out of turn historically, it would have been leapt on. But yet we don't seem to find that. I mean, when we look at Josephus, writing a bit later in the first century, he declares what the Christians believed. Obviously, he doesn't accept it, but he does seem to say that this is what they believed about the miracles of Jesus, about his resurrection and so forth. And there's no implication there here that he was just the kind of sage that Mr. Pullman is putting forward. He didn't just go around telling nice stories. His whole ministry was about certain events that he did, not just his teaching, his healing, his exorcisms and so forth. And I think we need to look at that and look at it in the context that of first century historical practice.
What do you have to say to that, Philip?
Well, it's always a disadvantage to take up issue with somebody who hasn't read the book under discussion, and I understand that you haven't had time to do that, but it does put us both at a bit of a disadvantage. Just
yes.
To take your point about Paul, though, and about the fact that his his writings were the first that we have of the writings of Christians. I found, when I read the Gospels and the epistles of Paul in preparation for this, I found something which I hadn't noticed before, and I found something that I thought was very interesting, which is simply the names that they use. In the Gospels, we hear the name Jesus more often than not. In the Gospels of Paul, it's Christ. Already, 20 years or however long it was after the death of Christ, the death of Jesus, Paul was referring to him as Christ 150 plus times, and he only uses the name Jesus 30 or so times. So for Paul, already he was taking his thinking into a very strong and different direction. It was the Christ aspect of the character, the Son of God aspect of the character, the risen, resurrected, and pre-existing indeed Christ, rather than the historical Jesus, who was of interest because of course Paul had never met the physical, the historical man in the flesh, though he claims to have seen a vision of him after his death. So there is a difference of emphasis already. As for the Gospels, well, the first Gospel to be written down is traditionally held to be that of Mark, which was written, what, AD 70, something like that? We don't know. We'll never know exactly. And that differs in tone so much from Luke, for example, to take another of the Synoptic Gospels, that you wonder whether they're describing the same event at some points. The crucifixion in Mark, for example, is a very stark and anguished affair. Jesus cries out, God, why have you forsaken me? Father, why have you forsaken me? In Luke, the atmosphere is completely different at the crucifixion. Jesus is, he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And, you know, tonight you'll be with me in paradise, he says to the thief. The atmosphere is, the two events is so different, and the events they describe, indeed, the sayings they describe are so different, they might have been two different men being crucified on two different occasions. So there are great differences among even the Synoptic Gospels. And what I'd like people to do when they've read my book is to go back and look at the Bible and read that, and see how much they've forgotten about how the Gospels differ among themselves, for example.
I'm sure you'll want to respond to that, Anthony. I mean, this is often a charge that's levelled at the Gospels, that there is a degree of variation between them, and that essentially what Philip has suggested there, that there is a theological agenda at work, that there is obviously an interest in making Jesus a particular type of character, and that perhaps Matthew and particularly John, people often pick up on, you know, as perhaps the most theologizing of all the Gospels, that we have the most deified Christ in the Gospel of John compared to the earliest Gospel, which is, of course, Mark. So what's your response there?
Well, first of all, I think this idea of the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, I think it's something that we need to reject immediately, because even Paul, when he talks about Christ, and remember, it was a title, which by the time that Paul is writing, the Christians are so absolutely sure that Jesus is the unique Messiah that they're using it almost as a name. Just like even nowadays when we talk about the Queen and Elizabeth II, it's the same person. You know, one's a title, one's a proper name, and so forth. Now, again, Paul roots what he says in the historical Jesus. He talks about, like in 1 Corinthians, about what Jesus did at the Last Supper. And then he talks about the resurrection, and he's not just talking about cosmic events, he's talking about what actually happened in the ministry of Jesus, and then he extrapolates from that for the life of the congregation to which he's writing. In regard to the so-called differences between the Gospels, I mean, again, this is something of an old chestnut. Obviously, in each case, in each of the four Gospels that are written, the writers want to emphasize a different, slightly different aspects of Jesus' ministry, but they're not contradictory by any means. We don't find Mark saying one thing and that Luke says that Jesus did the complete opposite, or saying that it didn't happen. We have certain emphases. Looking at if you look at any event in human history, and you have several different witnesses, so these witnesses will emphasize a different part of what they actually saw. Now, again, regarding John and his relation to the other Gospels, again, it's interesting that as long as living an apostle, he never actually contradicts what the earlier Gospels say. And even in the earlier Gospels, I think it's important to point out that we do find emphases there on Jesus being God, that Jesus claims this. And in Matthew 14:33, when after Jesus has walked on the water, it says that the disciples actually worshipped him. And again, at the end of Matthew, when the Great Commission is given in Matthew 28:19, it says, go and baptize people in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So Jesus actually puts himself on level with God the Father. So I don't accept that there is this historical distinction.
We're going to have to take a quick break here. Fascinating as this discussion is, we're going to have to interrupt slightly. We'll come back in a moment's time as we continue to discuss this book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. It's created quite a few waves of interest. Philip Pullman really writing perhaps his most religious book yet, and questions obviously surface naturally as we've been discussing about the authenticity, what we can trust, of what is of historical value in the Gospels, how much has been embellished, etc. And also with us, Martin Saunders, a Christian writer and broadcaster, and Martin is responding as well to the book. He's written a review recently of the book, and we'll continue to hear his thoughts on it. So do join us again in a couple of moments' time as we continue this discussion with Philip Pullman.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. We're looking at Philip Pullman's book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. My great pleasure to have Philip Pullman on the show with me today, someone I've long wanted to have on Unbelievable. So it's great to have him by phone this afternoon. In the studio with me, Martin Saunders. Martin, obviously, perhaps we can leave some of the biblical apologetics, as it's called, to Anthony, who's on the line with us as well. But from your point of view, you know, for the average Christian in the pew, as it were, I suppose the point is that the back cover states this is a story.
Yeah.
But for the average Christian, it's more than a story, isn't it? It's actually something that is so dear to their heart that to feel that there is some suggestion that it's not true, that and this kind of background issue about, can we distinguish truth from history? Mm. One of the phrases that gets repeated quite often in the book is this idea that, for instance, when the Mary and Martha story, Jesus decides to change that. So what we read originally happened in Philip's book is something quite different. And then at the end of that, it reads, when Christ heard about this, he knew it would be another of those sayings of Jesus that would be better as truth than as history. And there's this idea that myth is about bringing out the truth of something that is for the greater good, if you like, in that sense, than the necessarily historically what happened. But is it important to you that the stuff that happened in the Bible that you read actually really happened like that?
Before I answer that, the sort of first part of what you were asking, I think it's incredibly dangerous for Christians to become what Dawkins has sometimes termed sort of true believers, who simply blindly follow, never question, never doubt, you know, even though there are very many biblical examples of people wrestling, sometimes physically, with God. I think it's very dangerous if Christians simply disengage from the idea that this might not be true. I think we owe it to ourselves as human beings who consider ourselves to be intelligent to continually ask the question of ourselves, you know, why do I believe what I believe? What is the foundation of my faith? Are there other arguments? And to engage with them. Now, you know, I'm sure Philip doesn't spend his whole life getting out of bed every morning and saying, I am an atheist and I'm absolutely certain I'm right and I'm never, ever going to listen to anyone else for the rest of my life and I'm never, ever going to allow anyone to persuade me otherwise. I'm sure he would not do that, and yet, you know, sometimes as Christians that's how we are about our faith, and I think that's incredibly dangerous. I was very encouraged by you know, Philip's suggestion that he wants people to read this and then go back and read the Bible and let it sort of speak for itself, as it were. I think you know, I would suggest the transaction happens the opposite way. I think you know, Christians should come from their source material, the Bible, and actually look at this book and read it and see what it has to say and allow it to challenge them, and then go back to the Bible and say, well, you know, what do I believe? Why do I believe it? And I think that's a really important point. Christians need to engage with the other side of the debate, which is, of course, what the show is all about.
Absolutely. Philip, I'd be interested in your motives for writing the book, because are you kind of, in some sense, wanting to put questions into Christians' minds? Do you feel that the Christian world is too easily accepting of this kind of thing, people perhaps have swallowed the Gospels wholesale, and you feel that that needs to be addressed in some way, and that you're trying to do that?
Well, yes and no. I'm very encouraged by what the last speaker said, because I hope that's exactly how people will respond. But I think that the people who do believe that the Bible is literally true and inerrant, as they say, well, they won't read this book. They won't read my book anyway. But I didn't expect that they would. I expected plenty of criticism from them without having read it, but that's beside the point. What I did expect, and what I've found, to my great pleasure, is that thoughtful, thinking Christians would react to it in a thoughtful and thinking way, and understand that I'm not writing a literal something I want to be taken as the truth, but I'm writing a fable, which is a way of understanding something by exaggerating some things and leaving out others, and generally making it into something that is a story rather than a historical account, for example. So I'm not surprised that thinking Christians have reacted well to this book. I wouldn't have thought otherwise. I'm a great admirer of Richard Dawkins for many ways, but I don't agree with him that the main problem with religious people is that they believe something that isn't true. I don't think that's the main problem. I spent all my life writing things that aren't true, and I'm quite happy with what other people believe that aren't true. The problem is not what people believe, but what they do as a consequence of that belief.
Right, and in what sense, then, does the book address that? I mean, what you have in the book is this character, this rather shadowy figure we never learn the name of, who is sort of directing Christ in his annotations.
Yes.
And he's obviously trying to create something. From what I understand, the church.
Well, he is. He is trying to create the church. That's what he's doing. I don't give him a name, but if you were to give him a name, you could call him the angel of the church or something of the sort, if you like to do that. And what he tells Christ about the truth about the church is true. The church will provide all sorts of sustenance and moral and mental and emotional help for people. It will look after the sick and the dying. It will look after the poor and feed the hungry. It will do all those things, and it will do them because it believes, or it embodies a belief that one man died and rose again. That's why the church does it. And Christ, my character Christ in the book, sees that this is a terrible paradox, because the vision that the church will ultimately embody is not the vision of the Jesus he knew. But unless he tells these stories about the Jesus he knew, the Jesus will be forgotten, and there will be no church to do these good things. It's a tragic paradox, if you like.
Now, again, I don't want to conflate the book with what you actually believe happened, but is there a sense in which you do believe we can get back to what the historical Jesus believed, and you believe that the church, what the church teaches today, is completely at odds with that? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Well, you only have to look at the way Jesus lived and spoke, and then look at the gaudy panoplies of splendor and magnificence that surround the Vatican, for example, or some very rich and well-off churches in the Bible Belt of America, with everybody driving a Cadillac and wearing beautiful suits and having their hair pompadoured and the gleaming teeth and so on. You only have to look at all that to realize that that wasn't really what Jesus was talking about. He was talking about something else. He had something else in mind. And, you know, sell all of the house and give to the poor is something that the church that we have, that we know, has never actually done.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because obviously many Christians would agree with you. You know,
exactly what I mean. I'm sure men and women of goodwill, Christians or not, would agree with me, because it seems to be the blatant truth.
I suppose the question is, though, obviously the church is a human institution and has all the faults of a human institution, but are we to... Now, is its claim, though, that Jesus was the Son of God, has that, as it were, been orchestrated in some way? Because obviously the book has this character really orchestrating something whereby Jesus will then become to be revered as God and this death and resurrection.
People wouldn't believe an organization if it just said, we'll do these things because they're good things.
But do you
do these things because Jesus, the Son of God, told you to do these things, and if you do them, you'll go to heaven. That's a much stronger way of persuading people to do things, which may be good things to do. But that's the way it persuades them.
Are you a conspiracy theorist, though, in that sense that you do believe, you know, that it really was a trick, you know,
It wasn't a trick. It happened accidentally and piecemeal over centuries. It wasn't until the 4th century that the canon of the scripture was finally settled anyway. So there were all sorts of different accounts floating around before that. So it wasn't a conscious trick. That's just part of my fable.
Well... it would be interesting at this point to bring in Anthony McRoy, and perhaps, Anthony, to sort of set you up with this, I think one very interesting passage that kind of essentially illustrates what Philip's just described is where after Jesus has died in the book and then apparently resurrected, though in fact, as it emerges, it was his twin brother Christ who was the figure who
You're
was
giving it away. You're giving the plot away.
I'm sorry. I'm doing that terrible thing where everyone won't need to buy the book now that I've read it out. No, go and buy the book still. This is, I'll read from near the end of the book here, Anthony. And as time passed, Christ began to hear the story changing little by little. It began with Jesus' name. At first he was Jesus simply, but then he began to be called Jesus the Messiah or Jesus the Christ, and later still it was simply Christ. Christ was the Word of God, the light of the world. Christ had been crucified. Christ had risen from the dead. Somehow his death would be a great redemption or a great atonement. People were happy to believe that, even though it was hard to explain. The story developed in other ways, too. The account of the resurrection was greatly enhanced when it began to be reported that after Thomas asked to see the wounds, Jesus had shown them and let Thomas lay his finger in them to settle his doubts. So there's this sense in which, you know, this whole idea of the embellishment and essentially the way that myths develop is by word of mouth and people kind of repeating things and then exaggerating them a little bit, etc. What, as a Bible scholar, you don't believe that that is the way that these accounts were passed on to us. What gives you the confidence to say that the accounts we have of Jesus' life in the four synoptic gospels are not exactly the type of thing that Philip describes here in the book?
Well, maybe just say that I do speak as someone who does believe the Bible is inerrant, but I hope I'm a thinking Christian, and I don't just accept it on the basis of, as what people would say, a leap of faith. I think that can actually be historically defended, and I think I need to come back to the point I made earlier, that Paul quotes earlier tradition in many parts of his epistles. And like I said, come back to the fact that Paul's corpus of writings are the earliest in the New Testament. And he quotes, when he quotes earlier tradition, he does things, does so about the crucifixion, the Last Supper, about the resurrection, about the sonship of Jesus. So obviously, this was something that was rare right from the start. It wasn't embellished in later years. And in each of the Gospels, we find this assertion of Jesus being the Messiah. And so again, this is not a sort of later accretions that come in. So I think we have to look at the fact that, as I said before, Jews of this period in Palestine at this time were taking down notes. And like I said, the Christianity does not emerge in a context where it's got political control and whereby it can dictate what will be the popular understanding. I mean, the church was persecuted for the first 3 centuries of its existence. And if it said something out of turn, its opponents would have jumped on it. You know, if they said something that was not historically based, they would have been able to come against it. Finally, could I just add one little point? What Mr. Pullman said isn't exactly correct about the canon. The only troubles that seems to have been about the canon were largely about some of the minor Catholic epistles and the Book of Revelation, and that was particularly because of the Montanist phenomenon in Asia Minor, in particular Phrygia, arose in the late 2nd century, and that caused some problems for some people in the East, particularly about the Book of Revelation to a large extent. For the most part, the Gospels, the Pauline epistles, were always accepted as canonical, as authoritative scripture throughout the Roman Empire and, you know, those places beyond where Christianity also reached, such as Persia, Armenia, and Ethiopia, and so forth.
You sounded like you wanted to come in there at one point.
Just to answer that last point, the reason that the 4 Gospels that we have in the New Testament survived and made it into the canon is quite simple. They're the best. They're by far the best accounts, the best storytelling, the best narratives, they're the most richly written, the most imaginative, the most beautifully told of any of the Gospels. But if you look at the apocryphal Gospels beside them, and they're just no good at all. The Gnostic Gospels are full of empty words. The 4 Gospels that we have survived because they were the best. And I think we can see something Darwinian at work here. Now this will please people. The church and its beliefs, it seems to me, evolved because they were adaptive. They helped and were useful. They were good things to believe. They helped people to believe and to do things that they wouldn't have had the courage or the strength of mind to do otherwise. That's why they survived. It's not because they were true necessarily, but because they were adaptive, because they helped.
I'm sorry, I really don't think that is historically valid. I agree with you that stylistically they're much superior to any of these so-called Gnostic Gospels or things like the so-called Gospel of Thomas. But the criteria for canonicity that was used by the early church centered on apostolicity. It had to be written by someone who lived in the apostolic age.
But do you really believe that the Apostle John wrote John's Gospel?
Yes, I guess they do, yeah. And the point
the Apostle is... John, who is the same age as Jesus?
Let me just finish. The point is, we can find a history of transmission in canonical history straight away. I mean, the Gospel of John, the Gospel of Matthew, and everything are being quoted very early on. For example, in not so much the Gospel of John because it's written about the same time, but the Epistle of Clement of Rome to the Philippians. It's obviously alluding to many texts in the Gospels. Then, if we go into the immediate apostolic period, we find followers of the Apostle John like Ignatius of Antioch and Polycarp and Papias and so forth. And there is a history of transmission and of traditional use. Now, this is why none of these so-called Gnostic Gospels ever got a look in. And in fact, usually, if you look at what the Gnostics believed, they actually did accept the canonical Gospels, but they were more like the Mormons. They added on their own particular texts as well. And this is why, obviously, people, you know, the early church recognized that these so-called Gospels were written after the apostolic age. There was no history of usage, no history of transmission, and so, you know, the Orthodox Christians just refused to accept.
I mean, what you're saying
on a historical rather than a theological basis.
What you're saying as well seems to be that Anthony and we'll have Philip respond to this, that Philip doesn't give enough credence to the tradition of passing things on accurately at the time. You seem to be saying what Philip sees as would have inevitably been a kind of word of mouth, Chinese whispers type of affair, where something one thing turned into a different thing. You're saying that actually isn't the way that things happened at that time. They were pretty good at passing things on and things not changing, even perhaps before they were formally written down.
Yeah, and not just that, but like I said, we need to look at the fact that there are people around who are opposed to what the Christians are saying. We find some of the priesthood, or the Jewish priesthood at the time, and some of they oppose it. Remember, Origen has a famous, or Justin rather, in the early 2nd century, has a dialogue with Trypho the Jew. We find the pagans disagreeing with what the Christians are saying. And so, obviously, the Christians aren't imposing what their view of history on in the same way that we read in Orwell's 1984, when the party imposes its own vision of history and everyone's got to do a double think to agree with it. The Christians were not in a position to be able to do so for the first three centuries of their existence. I think that is a very good guarantee of its authenticity of the message.
Philip, what do you make of that? Because in a sense, in the book, you have this authority figure in the form of this angel who is sort of directing things as far as the way he would like to see this story develop and emerge. Now in reality, there wasn't a kind of overall figure doing that. There was no sort of, in that sense, political structure to Christianity in those early centuries. And is it fair enough what Anthony says there, that therefore this idea that someone was controlling the text and bringing out the things that they wanted to bring out, and because it simply wouldn't have happened, and if things weren't true that were said, they could have been shot down for
them. But as I've said many times throughout this interview and other places, this is not, I'm not intending this to be a true account. This is a fable. I'm taking certain aspects out and exaggerating them and changing other aspects simply in order to make a point.
Well, you're listening to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget, if you'd like to interact on any of the issues we've been talking about with our special guest, Philip Pullman, today, you're welcome to drop me an email at unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also phone and leave me a voicemail message, 08456 52 52 52, select option 8. Don't forget, the Premier community is a great place as well if you want to engage in this kind of debate. I'm sure there'll be a thread going on there in a very short amount of time on the programme today. That can be accessed via the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Just click on the Premier community to join in. And don't forget, that webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, is where you can find this podcast and many, many, many more besides. Now, in addition, you may want more than just the Unbelievable discussion on this. Well, the kind folk at English Pen, which is a literary society who hosted a debate recently between Philip Pullman and Lord Richard Harris, the former Bishop of Oxford, well, they've given us the use of the audio that they captured of that particular debate a few weeks ago. So if you want to listen to that as well, we're hosting it now at the features part of our Unbelievable webpage. So again, visit premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And click on the features tab, and you can listen back to that program as well at your own leisure. And I will, of course, include a link to that with the podcast of today's program.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Perhaps we can turn to the subject of the church, because in many ways that does figure quite a lot in your other writings as well. I'm thinking particularly of the Dark Materials trilogy, where...
Well, that's a church in another world.
Yes, but many people have drawn from your description of the magisterium in his Dark Materials as a sort of idea of this authoritarian structure, power structure, that leads people to believe something even though it's not true. And obviously the character in The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ is a similar sort of figure in my mind. He is essentially there to create this structure called the church. Are you being slightly unfair, though, to what the church is? The average Christian doesn't see the church necessarily as a kind of hegemonic sort of force that is there to sort of dictate what people can and can't believe.
No. But to go back 400 years, 500 years, and that's exactly what it was. The church has had a very interesting and very changeable history. At the moment, the Christian church, in Western Europe anyway, seems to have reached a point where it's it doesn't have very much political power anymore. It has to work by persuasion and by tradition and by exhortation and that sort of thing. So it's more or less harmless politically. But there was a time when it was not harmless politically, when what you believed made the difference between whether you were allowed to live or whether you'd be tortured to death hideously. And if you were a Catholic, you were tortured to death hideously here, and if you were a Protestant, you were tortured to death hideously 100 miles away. It's a terrible and a ghastly history. But it is no different from the history of a state like Soviet Russia, which was also a theocracy. And I've made this point many times. Any power, any authority, any body of people that wields a power in the name of an authority that may not be challenged is desperately dangerous. In the period of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, the Church, whether Protestant or Catholic, wielded this sort of power. Nowadays it doesn't. But in the early part of the 20th century, Soviet Russia wielded this sort of power in the name of an authority that might not be challenged, which is, in other words, the works of Marx. And there was a priesthood, which was the Catholic, which was the Communist Party. There was a teleological view of history, and this is very important. They had the notion that history was moving towards a particular end, and they knew what that end was. And anybody who helped this on its way was good, and anybody who didn't was a heretic and had to be destroyed. There are many, many similarities between a pure God-believing theocracy and an atheist theocracy, and the danger is not the God belief, but the theocracy, the political power wielded in the name of this authority that may not be challenged. That's where the danger comes.
Martin, bring you in at this point. I mean, in many ways, Jesus has things to say about power and kingdoms in the Gospels, and it's not particularly different, perhaps, to what Philip's just been saying. You know, my kingdom is not of this earth, etc. I mean, do you agree with Philip's assessment, though, of the wrongs of the church?
Well, I do. I mean, when Philip was talking, I don't know if it was like this, but when he was talking before, I did tune out for a moment and think I was listening to a really good preacher, you know, attacking some of the things. I mean, there are absolute direct hits. You think about the Crusades, you think about the Inquisition, you think about what you were saying earlier about the sort of majestic structures of church buildings in parts of the world and car parks full of sort of pastors' vehicles that are extraordinary. Large and well kitted out, and we know that to be true, and I don't think we challenge it enough. I think so I was quite encouraged to hear that actually is part of Philip's concern, and I guess my question back to him would be, you know, how would you, given that there are 2 billion Christians on the earth, you know, and that the church is this extraordinarily large organization which, you know, is not about to die out anytime soon. What would Philip want the church to be like? Actually, if you could now be the architect, Philip, and you could speak a message to us, and I'm not going to let you have disband as your kind of sermon. You can't say that. But disbanding apart, you know, what would your message be to Christians? What would you want the church to do? How would you like it to change? What would you like it to be aware of?
Well, I described what I would like the church to be in the words I gave to Jesus in the Gethsemane chapter. He says, here we are, Lord, if I thought you were listening, I'd pray for this above all, that any church set up in your name should remain poor and powerless and modest, that it should wield no authority except that of love, that it should never cast anyone out, that it should own no property and make no laws, that it should not condemn but only forgive, that it should be not like a palace with marble walls and polished floors and guards standing at the door, but like a tree with its roots deep in the soil that shelters every kind of bird and beast and gives blossom in the spring and shade in the hot sun and fruit in the season, and in time gives up its good sound wood for the carpenter, but that sheds many thousands of seeds so that new trees can grow in its place. Does the tree say to the sparrow, get out, you don't belong here? Does the tree say to the hungry man, this fruit is not for you? Does the tree test the loyalty of the beasts before it allows them into the shade? That's what I would like to see a church being like. And churches in poor areas who minister to the poor and serve the poor and pay no heed to the desires and bullying of the rich, that's the sort of church I'd like to see. And it does exist, and I laud it, and I celebrate it, and I praise it.
You see, for me, there speaks the voice of Jesus Christ through Philip Pullman. And I
well, I wasn't expecting to hear that, but that's what I believe.
But, I'm totally on board with that message. And you know, for me, there's a biblical precedent as well. You look at what happened to Solomon taking over from David. Of course, Solomon built this, built the church, built the temple, and it all, you know, all came crashing down, and the Israelites went back into exile. So there's definitely a biblical precedent for this. And I think there are a couple of direct hits that we need to be really aware of as Christians here. The other one is actually the central conceit about how stories become stories. Because I know that, you know, as a Christian, as a churchgoer, who someone who believes, who they've seen miraculous things happen in their life, in and around their life, certainly. You know, I know there is a Christian tendency sometimes towards what I would term sort of evangelisticity. If that's not a word, but you get what I'm getting at. That we see something happen that actually does speak of God, and we, as we retell that story, we add to it and we bolt onto it. And I have to put my hand up and say that does happen. That is not to suggest that God doesn't do miraculous things, that God isn't, you know, working in people and in his church. But I do think that we do ourselves no favours by then attempting to make God sound even better. Mm. As actually, you know, so I think that's a really powerful message to take from this. But I think I have to restate, you know, I think this stuff, miraculous stuff, does happen. It stands on its own merit.
We're going to have to take another quick break, and then we'll finish up with just some final thoughts from our guests who have joined me today. Philip Pullman with me on the line. He's talking about his new book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. Also, who's part of the conversation is Anthony McRoy, who has been taking issue with some of the aspects of whether there is a reliability to the gospel text, a historicity that we can trust in. And Martin Saunders, who's a Christian writer and broadcaster, who's been putting in his two pennies worth as well during the course of the programme. So join us again in just a moment as we conclude our discussion. Unbelievable, the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking on a regular basis. Just another reminder that if you want to listen to more debate between Philip Pullman and a Christian, in this case Lord Richard Harris, the former Bishop of Oxford, they had a fascinating discussion under the auspices of The English Pen, which is a literary society. We are going to be putting that up with this podcast, so follow the link to the features part of the Unbelievable webpage. If you want to just go there straight away, it's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And click on the features tab, and you'll be taken to there. You can listen to that, another really fascinating discussion that I would highly recommend. Join us again next week. Just an advance notice of another author coming in to join us, somewhat different to Philip Pullman. Peter Hitchens is the brother of arch atheist Christopher Hitchens. They've never seen eye to eye, not least on their difference of views on faith. Peter Hitchens is a very committed Christian. His latest book, The Rage Against God, looks at the phenomenon spearheaded by his atheist brother of the new atheism, and it's his response to it. He'll be here in conversation with atheist journalist Adam Rutherford. Peter Hitchens himself is a journalist writing predominantly for the Mail on Sunday. So do join us for that. Should be a fascinating discussion on his latest book, The Rage Against God.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, thanks to all my guests who've been with me on the programme today. Fascinating book, Philip. And again, if you want to get hold of it, available in all good bookstores. And I've even seen Christian publications publicising it on their pages, Philip, because I think many people will see this as a good way of stimulating debate. I think many people...
Well, I think that would be a very, very good outcome. I'd be very happy to see it, you know, being discussed in church groups or in people's houses. That's exactly what I want.
Well, that's excellent. And I've even seen it sort of put in the format of, well, here's the Philip Pullman account and here's someone else's account, sort of, so people can have two sort of views. And what for me, though, is interesting, Philip, is that you don't sound like you're anti-church, per se. You sound like you're anti-certain forms of church. You sound like you're quite pro-Jesus, in a way.
Yeah, very, very pro-Jesus.
So you're an atheist who's for Jesus.
Well, I shall never be a Christian, but you can call me a Jesusite.
Okay. Well, I mean, from that point of view, what does it take away from it then for you when a Christian goes that extra step and says, I believe Jesus was the good man, the good teacher, and the things that you believe about him, Philip, but I believe he was more than that. I believe he was the Son of God, and I believe he did die and rise again. And that, in an extraordinary way, gives me hope for the future. Now, you write about this from the point of view of the angel in the book telling him this event, whether it's a trick or not, will give people hope for the future. So you seem to see that there is a value in that belief, but it's one you could never embrace, presumably.
Well, that's right, yeah. That's right. And Jesus had a phrase for this, as he had a phrase for everything. You know, by their fruits shall you know them. What do people do as a result of behaving like this, of believing this? If all they do is go home and feel righteous, there's no fruit on that tree. But if somebody goes out and does some good in the world, then you salute them, cheer them, thank them. That's the test always. What result does it have in the world? This is why I like the Epistle of James, which apparently Martin Luther couldn't stand. But I like the Epistle of James because it emphasizes good works, the value of good works. I'm all for that.
Martin, as a Christian, you believe the same things about Jesus in terms of his the moral teachings and everything. But is there something more? Is there a reason why believing in his deity and his resurrection somehow makes it more for you than just understanding and learning from the teachings of a great man?
Well, ultimately, I do believe his claims. I mean, that's the difference between us. And I believe that Jesus is God, and that he, you know, actually there is some totally mind-bending way in which each of us are able to engage in an ongoing dialogue with him today. And so, you know, if that's available, then I've always said, you know, I'm all for it. And I'm sure, to be fair, you know, Philip obviously can speak for himself, but Philip, as I said before, is not a man of a closed mind, as he's demonstrated in this book. And if that actually came along and presented itself as a reality to him, it's not something he would he'd turn away from. So for me, it is something that I have in my life discovered for myself and believe to be true. You know, I pray that one day Philip will find the same.
Well, Philip, you're obviously seen as an atheist in this country who's has a lot of influence in many ways. You don't sound, though, like you're anti-Christianity. I mean, lots of the new atheism has a very anti-Christian tenor to it.
Yeah, well, I think if we were back 400 years, as I said, I'd be anti-Christian too. But the I'm not anti anyone. I'm anti bad behavior, whether it's bad behavior by a child or by a state. I'm anti-cruelty, anti-oppression, anti-dictatorial ways of thinking. That's what I'm anti.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you for joining us on the program today. And all my thanks as well to Anthony McRoy, who joined us as well, and to Martin Saunders, who was our guest here in the studio. As I say, Philip Pullman's The Good Man, Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ, available now at good bookstores. And you can also find it online. I'll put up some links to this program. Don't forget to check back there for the podcast as well. premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you're there and you're wanting to get in touch to express your views and your reactions to today's programme, you're more than welcome to drop me a line, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Many of you have done that in regard to the last few weeks of programming. We'll hear some of your feedback in just a short moment's time. But before we hear some of that, let me tell you that tonight, and if you're going to hear this in time, you'll probably have to be listening live this Saturday afternoon. But if you get this in time, you can go to a special debate on the subject of human morality and where it comes from, called Can We Be Good Without God? It's being hosted by Gunnersbury Baptist Church, and it's the third in a very interesting series of debates they've been holding between atheists and Christians. You may remember we covered one of them at the end of last year on the whole area of science and faith. Well, tonight, 7 p.m, Gunnersbury Baptist Church in Chiswick, you can hear that debate on Can We Be Good Without God? And the debaters are Professor Richard Norman, Vice President of the British Humanist Association. And he's going to be opposite the Reverend John Richardson, Anglican Minister of St. Peter's Church in Ugly, known as the Ugly Vicar. That's his online profile. So if you would like to get along to that, you can pretty much just turn up at the door. Gunnersbury Baptist Church in Chiswick. Saturday the 8th of May, that's today at 7 p.m. And if you want more information, you can probably find that by going to their website. I don't have that detail with me right now, but they're located on Wellesley Road, the Gunnersbury Baptist Church. That's in Chiswick, London. Okay, let's look at back at some of your correspondence. We've had some really, really interesting shows recently. Last week, we featured that discussion on do we need God now that we have science? There's been a number of scientific programmes in this year on Unbelievable. Given that it was last year that all the Darwin anniversaries happened, it's somewhat ironic that this year we've decided to suddenly have a rash of science programmes on Unbelievable. But anyway, last week we were looking at the Test of Faith initiative. Still time to go along, by the way, to that lecture happening on the 19th of May at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity, Dr. Ruth Bankovich and other guests taking part in that. But we had from the Test of Faith campaign with us last week Dennis Alexander, who's a Cambridge biologist and Christian. He was debating atheist philosopher Stephen Law. And there's already a very lively correspondence going on both on Stephen's blog, which you can find by looking at the programme from last week, and indeed at the Premier Community, the Unbelievable group there, where the Manic Street Preacher has started a thread on that particular programme, particularly on the issue of the evil God thought experiment that Stephen Law presented Dennis with. Let's get some of your reaction, though, to that programme that came in by email. Kyle wanted to pick up right at the start of the show when I asked Stephen about whether he thought most philosophers were of an atheistic bent. And I think Stephen replied by saying that, as far as he was aware, the best survey showed that about 15% of philosophers were theists, the rest having clinging to some form of atheism. Kyle Essery emails to say, I'm sure that others have let you know by now, but the poll that Stephen Law referred to at points in this week's episode was neither international nor formal. He was referring to an informal survey led by David Chalmers and available online at Phil Papers. He polled philosophers and students at 100 universities in America. Stephen was correct that 15% said they accepted theism and 70% accept or lean towards atheism, with another 15% unsure. Of course, the results were very interesting, but were mainly from philosophers of science, mind, biology, mathematics, etc., and other fields that have little knowledge or familiarity with theistic arguments for or against God's existence. In fact, some 80% of the philosophers who responded were in fields that have no interaction with any of the pertinent discussions. For most of those asked, we should expect their knowledge of the topics to be little more than the knowledge on these topics by professors in architecture or the culinary arts. More interesting were the results of those who are actually philosophers of religion and thus studied in the arguments for and against God's existence. Of these professors, which would be considered experts in the pertinent topic, 72.3% either accept or lean towards theism, with 19.1% accepting or leaning towards atheism. It made me think of a quote from atheist philosopher Quentin Smith, commenting on the overall ignorance of most philosophers to argument for or against God's existence. He said, "The great majority of natural philosophers have an unjustified belief that naturalism is true and that theism is false." Of course, the last major and formal study of university professors in America was in 2006 by UCLA, revealing that only 10% were outright atheist and 13.4% were agnostic, with the rest having various forms of theistic beliefs. In fact, the majority of professors in almost every field were theists, with only a few fields, psychology and biology, for instance, having a majority of unbelievers. There you go. Thank you for that input, Kyle. Really interesting to get that background to that particular study. Polls can be truly misused was the title of your email. If you know anything different to that, if you have an alternative point of view or can point to any other studies, I'd be welcome to hear of them. None of this essentially, of course, proves whether God does or doesn't exist. Statistics can't do that, but it is interesting to see where most people put themselves theologically. Now, as to the substance of the debate last week, we really delved into the philosophical side of things on whether we can, you know, put the fine tuning of the universe, for instance, as having explanatory power to give us some sense that there is a God, that God can be used as an explanation, even philosophically. But This was what Xander, who's an atheist, emailed in to say. I count this among the best shows ever. I really like listening to Stephen Law and his philosophical perspective. I think you miss the point, Justin, when you claim that we can separate the question of whether there is a God from what sort of qualities God may have. Let me illustrate this point. I presume you would agree that Apollo does not exist. How do you know this? One way is by noting that he supposedly drives his chariot across the sky every day to make the sun rise and set. Well, this contradicts our modern understanding that the illusion of the sun rising and setting is a result of us living on a planet that rotates on its axis. Suppose I say, okay, that story about the chariot isn't true, but all the other stories are. Well, you could take on another myth and show how implausible it is. And you could continue to the point that I say, okay, maybe we don't exactly know what Apollo is like or what he does, but I still think he exists. The problem is that everyone has assumptions and connotations that they associate with Apollo, and so it's misleading for me to claim credibility for this vague entity who's called Apollo but is nothing like what everyone understands Apollo to be. If I do that, I need to be clear that I've redefined the word Apollo, and I can't use any of the stories about the mythical Apollo to understand what my Apollo is like. Similarly, in order to establish the likelihood of God existing, it is essential to know what sort of God you are contemplating. It's okay to redefine a word such as God however you want, but then it's not reasonable to pretend that you haven't redefined the word, says Xander. Now, on this same issue of the evil God, whether you know, it's just as makes just as much sense to ask whether there is an evil God as a good God in control of the universe. Mike Ranieri in Toronto in Canada says, love the show, been listening since 2007. I want to respond to Stephen Law's evil God challenge. First, this idea is not new. It's very similar to arguments for the existence of multiple gods, including good and bad gods, an uncaring or disinterested God, and even a not-so-powerful God. In regard to this, you might want to consider having Greg Boyd on the show to talk about open theism sometime. In fact, the evil God idea was first brought up on your show by Peter Cave in 2008. You've got a great memory there, Mike, and I had a feeling that I'd heard this somewhere when Stephen was talking about it. You say, now for this argument to work, one has to assume a symbiotic relationship between good and evil. But good and evil are not merely mutually similar opposite entities. They're not indiscriminate opposites like black and white, nor are they opposite like a drought is to a flood, as both are equally destructive. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, good and evil are not a duality where good cannot exist without evil, nor evil without good. Though in the tradition, good can and will eventually exist without evil. For this reason, it isn't sufficient to defend this premise by simply reversing the good God theodicy. Good and evil are opposites, as war and peace are opposite. One can't simply reverse the tactics of war to generate peace. The direct opposite of martial law during war would be no law during peace. There's a significant difference between a country dropping bombs on its enemy and its foreign aid policy. The goals, results, and consequences of war and peace are different, as are that of good and evil. The main problem with the evil God argument is it ignores the nature of evil. Evil is a destructive force which, if left to run rampant, will eventually result in chaos. Well, that's still going on. If you want to get involved at the discussion on that issue going on at the Premier community, then I do encourage you to get involved there. Premier.org.uk/unbelievable and click on the Premier community tab. That'll take you to the Unbelievable group and you'll see some of the thoughts going around on that. Thanks to others who have been getting in touch on various of the science faith debates that we've been hosting recently. This one from Graham says, I think that some of the atheists on your show fight shy of the consequences of consistently holding to a naturalistic worldview. Tom Clark of the Center for Naturalism and producer of the very extensive website naturalism.org takes on some of the challenging outworkings of a thorough acceptance of the naturalistic worldview, such as there is no such thing as libertarian free will, and how this leads to a call to the re-evaluation of retributive justice. He presents his views in a very positive and civil manner, and I'm sure would be a great participant. Well, you're not the only person, Graham, to have emailed suggesting we do some kind of discussion on the whole area of free will and how it's affected by a very thoroughgoing naturalism. I'm not sure that Stephen Law would necessarily, as he said last week, subscribe to that kind of naturalism, which is purely materialistic, perhaps because of the, you know, philosophical effects it has on the fact that it means effectively there is no such thing as free will. Everything is simply cause and effect. But thank you for your email, and again, it's going in the ideas bag, and I do try and act on as many ideas as I can. Nick Quinn says, I can't thank you enough for the spectacular job that you and the Premier staff are doing on putting together a wonderful show. It's challenging, eye-opening, and yet so informative. I learnt so much, not just about the topics that your guests discuss, but also how they discuss it. So many times I've been impressed by both the Christian and atheist, and how friendly, open, and honest they are, or aren't. This is helping me see how our approach to others is what predominantly will be the driving force to help them see our argument for the existence of God, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and the offer of salvation in his name. I made a decision to follow Christ in college, and am actively involved in a non-denominational church in San Jose, California, due to a close friend of mine who decided to leave the faith due to an inability to reconcile doubts. I have embarked on an intellectual journey that has led me to your show and to investigate issues surrounding Christianity to better answer his questions. I've long been compelled to accept evolution as a valid theory to explain how life on Earth developed. Since then, I've read many books outlining an even-handed approach to being a Christian, theistic evolution, and how that can be consistent with accepting evolutionary theory. And you go on to list some of the books by people who I've had on the show. And you say, although many of these books do a great job outlining how being a Christian is not inconsistent with the theory of evolution, none of them do an adequate job, in my opinion, of explaining how an approach to Genesis in general, including the creation account and beyond, can be interpreted to be consistent with an evolutionary perspective. Maybe this is because they are, for the most part, scientists and not theologians. You say that what you'd really like to see is a look on one of our shows at whether Adam and Eve were historical characters and how you explain things like the genealogies in Genesis and references elsewhere. Things like, was the biblical flood universal? Well, those are all huge questions and ones that I'm sure we will get around to looking at in detail. Nick, thank you very much for your interest in the show. Thank you so much for the fact that it's really helping you in many ways. I like the fact that often when people email, they say things like this. Luke McGurdy from Ireland says, I want to compliment you and all the unbelievable staff for doing an excellent job with your weekly broadcast. I'm afraid it's just me, Luke. Yes, I am the producer, editor, presenter, and everything else. It's a bit of a one-man deal here, but I am grateful to Premier for giving me the space to develop this kind of a show. You say, Luke, and you're in Ireland, I had long ago tired of the formalist theist versus atheist debates that populate the internet, and because of this I initially approached Unbelievable with a certain degree of cynicism as to its worth. However, I was pleasantly surprised by the refreshing informal discussion style, which I believe encourages honest interaction between your guests and enables them to get a little closer to the meat and bones of the topic. Added to this, I must compliment you on the admirable even-handed hosting that's evident during each debate I've listened to. Bearing all this in mind, I wish to offer a few suggestions for your consideration. And you've got some interesting suggestions, which I am taking on board, about the way that the shows are presented as podcasts and things. One of your suggestions, though, is that we should have a look again at the morality argument, but not just between a Christian and an atheist. You say, I've never heard a debate between an atheist who rejects objective morality and an atheist who accepts a type of objective morality. For example, Shelley Kagan, and of course a Christian. So you suggest to look at the debate between William Lane Craig and Shelley Kagan on the topic of morality. That can be found apparently at the Veritas Forum at veritas.org. You say it would be interesting to see how the two atheists would go about reconciling their differences. That is an interesting one. Thank you very much. You also add a personal note at the end. I think it is wonderful that Christians are seen to be engaging with others at an intellectual level. Far too often I felt that there is a vein of anti-intellectualism running through certain Christians, and some atheists are keen to encourage this perceived conflict between faith and the intellect. While I don't believe that one can come to know God solely through intellectual pursuit, it is important that Christians are knowledgeable about the world and its people that inhabit it. God bless you and all the work you do. Thank you. It was really encouraging to receive that email, Luke. And another encouraging one here from Joel Wakeford in Sydney, Australia. You're a science undergraduate student. You say, I have been an open-minded Christian for many years, and it's been my study of science that motivated me to delve into Christian apologetics in an attempt to help to reconcile my faith in light of scientific discoveries and defend my beliefs against my peers who know I am a Christian. Sounds like you're rather in a minority then in your laboratory, Joel. Whilst looking for podcasts in this area, I came across your show via iTunes a few months ago and have been more than impressed by it. Listening to your show has become somewhat of an addiction for me, even to the point I now welcome traffic on the way to and from uni just to listen to the podcasts of shows gone by. I know you get this a lot, but I truly wish there were more shows of this apologetic nature. In this age of misinformation, many are blindly persuaded by the often misleading and theologically uninformed arguments that the new atheists put forward. And sadly, many come to accept their views without even seeing the often very persuasive counter-arguments that many Christian apologists are offering. Therefore, I thank you for the show that allows these views to be aired and not just confined to the pages of books hidden away at the back of Christian bookstores. You also wanted to add a special note to congratulate David Robertson, who was, of course, on that show of a couple of weeks ago, grilling a Christian. He was grilled in that instance by four atheists. You say, I've listened to a number of the shows he's been on, and I've been very impressed by the firm and coherent manner in which he delivers his arguments. I thought his performance on the recent Grill a Christian episode was exemplary. Thank you very much, and I'm glad that you've really enjoyed those. Don't forget, if you want to get involved, those debates still going on the Premier community, where David and the four atheists who contributed to that show of a couple of weeks ago are all debating those same topics in threads there. Premier.org.uk/unbelievable if you'd like to get involved and join the growing community that is the Unbelievable group of that Premier community. Again, my webpage for both past programmes, the archive of past programmes there, and the features, as I mentioned earlier, that accompany some of these programmes, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And you can also, of course, click through to the Premier community. So thanks for listening today. It's been a really, really, historic show in many ways. As I say, it was super pleased to have Philip Pullman on the show. Hope we can get him for you again at some point in the future as well. I'm sure we will, if you're listening, Mr. Pullman. Now, let me tell you what's coming up on the show next week. We've got another author in. You're unbelievable. Not just an author, he's also a columnist for the Mail on Sunday. Outspoken in both his political and religious views, he is Peter Hitchens. He is the brother of prominent atheist Christopher Hitchens, but they couldn't be more different as far as their views of Christianity go. Peter is a very committed Christian. His latest book, The Rage Against God, is essentially an answer to the type of new atheism that his brother Christopher represents. He'll be explaining why he doesn't believe society can function properly without a thoroughgoing morality based in the supernatural, in the God of the Christian Bible. He's going to be in conversation on that very topic with Adam Rutherford. He's an atheist journalist for The Guardian, and he'll be talking to Peter about all sorts of things, including abortion, whether atheist states are atheist or religious in nature, and all sorts of other interesting stuff. You won't want to miss that show. Another cracker for you next week. Until then, do hope you can keep listening here on Premier Christian Radio. Lots more to come this afternoon. And don't forget to check out this podcast and others at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Until I meet you again next week, have a great one.